Well, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio none other than Dan Renshaw. Right. Welcome, Dan.
Good morning, Mike.
So today it's been cold down here. I always like to ask you, are you inverted?
In every way. Yes, just a few degrees today, a little bit of wind, and that will kind of destroy things. But flat light, difficult trip down the mountain because it was just absolutely flat light. So, nonetheless, quick trip. This time of year, we need snow desperately to ski upon. There's nothing but crust and ice everywhere.
Well, before we launch into the rest of the story, I'm interested, particularly since we've recently had the combination of NOAA and NASA pointing out that in the history of record keeping, whether it's here in the United States, whether it's in Japan, whether it's in England, we have just been experiencing the warmest temperatures on record over the last roughly 150 years. And I'm thinking, as you've described circumstances back in the day, whether at the beginning of last century or your own experience up there, this seems to be, and that's why they made the statements they did, the new abnormal.
Well, yeah, personally, it's part of a process. The big argument is this man-made, and everything tells me, no, it isn't, but is man adding to it? Well, yeah, obviously, yes. But it's been going on for quite a while. I think of little things like Captain Cook at the mouth of Glacier Bay, which is full of ice when
sure.
he visited there,
right.
And then, you know, 50 miles, and a few years later, it's retreated. There was dramatic involvement in climate change way back then.
Mm-hmm.
Another graphic example is closer to home. The Blaine brothers, who started the Alaska Central Railroad out of Seward in 1903, they wanted to start in Anchorage. At that time, it was considered to be Kinnick Anchorage, where the boats harbored. Specifically, they were going to put docks in at what they called Chester Bay. A big plan. This was something that they had asked the government if they could do this. And they were going to tap the coal resources and build a railroad from there all the way to the river system at Nenana. One of the Blaine brothers, I forget which one, was very studious. He went all the way back to Washington, D.C., to the Smithsonian Institute, and he found Vancouver's work in the late 1700s, where they had come in and done some sounding of the area around Upper Cook Inlet, specifically found deep water going all the way up to what today would be the highway bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Deep water, 90 feet of water. It was well-developed fjord. 100 years later, a little more than, here's Mr. Blaine looking at Kinnick Arm full of silt. And it freaked him out because he realized, wow, that happened, that filled, in 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the inlet's going to be full in another 100. I better move to a better port, and he chose Seward. But graphic stuff, because the glacier was melting so dramatically
mm-hmm.
that all of that material was being washed in and filled in Kinnick Arm. And that happened very quickly back then. So this climate change thing has been, it's had its episodes, I'm sure, faster and less. Right now, yeah, it's documented that we seem to be accelerating. Other measurements would argue with that. It's been graphic in just my lifetime that mm-hmm. there is definitely a big change going on.
And so whatever the cause, if you were to think back 50 years ago, and that's, I guess, the question, even with the questions about the causation. The reality is, looking out today, out the window, this feels, over the past 30-some-odd years, to be an unusual January. Not that it doesn't happen, but as the almanac has shown, that this is pretty unusual.
But it's become the standard unusual.
Yeah.
Seems like the last 3 or 4 years, if you get through November, there's always a cold spell in November, below zero. If you can get through that, that's it. That was winter.
Yep.
The rest of it is whatever you want to. I think I'm quoting you correctly in saying that you were commenting that it was flirting with 32 at its either side, and it doesn't work very well for us.
No. In particular, I'm thinking back in the day, as you've described transportation, the winter transportation, there wasn't a lot of, as you've described it, activity directly in mining, that would change the way you could move things. And the same thing in the summer, I would expect, especially thinking about changes in things like rainfall, which make mud holes and other things more difficult to traverse.
Yeah. We talked about the mud hole on Carl Wagon Road that the young William or Alan Horning was involved in. But.
Or even the streams we've been talking about in terms of the water supply for them. Has there been significant change from back in the day?
It was a frustration for them because the USGS documents that some years were dry. They could not get enough water together to do any milling, very little milling. And the next year, the next year was a flood, you know. This is the fickleness of weather in general. And they had too much water because, like Billy Martin, he's got his mill located in Fishhook Creek, and too much water is a real problem for him. Back and forth. So have I seen summers like that? Yeah, oh my, Mike, I've seen summers that were just a dream as far as warm weather, consistently wonderful, beautiful. Blueberries up high loved it. They don't like it down low, but there were blueberries just outside my door of my cabin, unusual. The plants are there on a normal year, wet and kind of dreary through July and August. At the lower levels, 1,000 feet lower, they love that. Up high, they won't even make a berry.
Okay. So, well, let's go on with our story then.
Okay. Now, we've been working with William and Pearl Horning, and I'll remind you of the picture on the wall in my cabin, their wedding day in Iowa in 1900. They left there intending to go west to, quote, seek their fortune. And the big news of the day when they got to Seattle was the Klondike was a thing of the past already. That rush had come and gone. But there was a new discovery at a place called Nome. And so let's give it a try. And it's an easy one to get to. You get on a boat,
right?
And you find yourself in Nome. They couldn't find any land available. They didn't want to just be working on the beach, which was a very temporary situation. And we talked about Nome, where people on the beach were making an ounce or better per day. They were doing very well. But William and Pearl finally located some placer ground near Council, which is east of Nome. And they had a near neighbor, a family, last name Black. And they became very close friends. And Mrs. Black became pregnant at the same time as Pearl. Pearl took it more serious as far as her son, wasn't going to be born in a territory. He was going to be born in the United States. She left and went to Seattle. They lost track of each other then. shortly after that, the Iditarod Gold Rush took place. William rushed to there, leaving counsel behind. And we find that the two get reacquainted sometime around 1915, 1916. The Black family ends up in Kinnick, just like Pearl and William had, taking a different circuitous route to get there. We find the Black family in the 1920 census, and they live on what became Fairview Loop Road, but way over on the east end near Matanuska. And they have quite a family. I think it's five children. We need to talk a little bit about the flu. Flu that came visiting to the world.
You know, right.
1918 was an especially bad year. That flu had a terrible effect in Alaska, especially native populations. There were native villages that were eradicated by this flu. And it went on and on. And in the big flare-up of the winter flu season of 1920, both Mr. and Mrs. Black died of the flu. And now there's these five kids in the community. The way things were done at that time, there was no government involvement. The community got together and divided the kids up. You know, somebody took a kid each, and the William and Pearl took a son named Sidney. Sidney turned out to be an extraordinary person. He was same age as Alan Horning, the William and Pearl's son. And they treated him. Now, this is would have been in 1921 that they unofficially adopted Sidney. But they took him in wholeheartedly. He became part of the family. No questions asked about it. He was an equal. You remember that in a prior session we were talking about the terrible accident in the mill at the War Baby Mine that bothered Charlie Barthoff so much he wanted to get away from the area.
Right.
This is over near the Lucky Shot part of the Craigie Creek Valley. And so they, William and Pearl, and they all decided, fine, they would sell out to this Mr. Thompson, who, interesting character we need to talk about, but he was a pharmacist from Toronto, Canada.
Oh,
and how in the world, you know, do you get somebody like that? But he had bought, in 1916, he had bought the bullion mine from the Barthoff family.
Okay.
Now 1920, he's wanting to expand. So he makes an offer on the War Baby and the newly discovered Lucky Shot. And perfect timing, they want out anyway, so they leave, not knowing what they had left behind, which was, you know, they really gave away the farm on that one. But they moved over to the Maple Mine, and this was in the early 20s. So Sidney becomes a very integral part of this family operation, developing the Mabel Mine, and they do quite well. They produce about 16,000 ounces in the next few years. Today's money, $16 million, you know, a lot of that goes back in the ground.
Sure.
But they're doing pretty well, by gosh. And Sidney becomes a very critical part of the family. Now, the family, the Horning family, includes a daughter. And she's, I believe, 7 years younger than Alan, which would make her born in 1912. So she's just a young girl when Sidney becomes part of the family. But Sidney is just overwhelmingly attracted to this sister. He just has a hard time containing himself. And he has in his mind that at some point in the future, they're going to find a way that they're going to be able to become a couple.
Okay.
This is all secret to everybody except Sidney. And as that daughter grows, first at the Mabel Mine And then later, when they moved from the Mabel back to the Gold Cord, it becomes a critical issue with Pearl that she is going to live vicariously through that daughter.
Oh.
The daughter's name was Jean. And this daughter is going to get to do everything that Pearl didn't get to do, which, oh, Mike, it, the list was amazing. Sent her to the Sorbonne in Paris.
okay,
for
okay.
College.
That's a good start.
And his summer was bicycle tours through Europe. I mean, this was, they were struggling financially, but by gosh, this was going to be the, going to happen. She's going to make it happen. Well, finally, the daughter, probably with a lot of pressure from the mother, Pearl, decided that she wanted to be a mining engineer. So she matriculates at the McKay School of Mines in Reno, Nevada. And this was an oddity at that time. There wasn't a lot of women in college, period. But for a woman to be in a a pursuing the degree of a mining engineer was unheard of. There just wasn't such a thing. But at the McKay School of Mines, there was two of them. And at graduation day came, these two women had a problem. They had to flip a coin to decide who was going to be the first graduate mining engineer from the McKay School of Mines. Well, it turned out Jean was number two. But she was in groundbreaking territory because of the pushing of her mother. Well, she's going to school. She's coming back to Alaska in the summer months. And now they have, we have talked about the move previous. I'll not try to go back and redo that. But they, the move from the Mabel Mine to the Gold Cord came in about 1929. And there was, at that time, let's see, 29, let's say 30. Jean is 18. She's into this college thing, and Pearl has all these plans. And you'll remember that Charlie Barthoff was very insistent that they buy the Gold Cord back because he knew that if they had just tunneled a little further on this pitched-out vein, that they'd find something. And they did. It was an astounding find there on the 100 level of the Gold Cord. So now Pearl is elated because she's got everything in place. They're in this new mine with this new big stope area with wonderful ore. They've got a mill. Everything is fine except it's seasonal. You'll remember that all of the mining up in the Hatcher Pass area before World War One and during and shortly after was essentially all seasonal because you were using water for milling. We talked previously, let me refresh the memory of the listener here, hopefully, about the Alaska Railroad, which was made a phenomenal change in Alaska, in the South Central region especially. When it came in, to begin with, there was a tremendous development upsurge in really all of Alaska, but specifically in the what would become the Rail Belt area. That was in 1915, the start of the Alaskan, let's call it by the name it had then, the Alaska Engineering Commission Railroad, was what it was called. The actual title, The Alaska Railroad, with a capital T on the V. That didn't happen until 1923 that it was officially named that. So when the railroad is being constructed, there was this big upsurge in population. There was a lot of development. Everything looked wonderful. And then, suddenly, here comes World War One. Our involvement in World War One. World War One started in 1914.
Right.
But, it was over there. And we didn't want anything to do with it. And we slowly got involved in it in April of 1917, declared war. And as nothing changes everything like a war does, a full committed war. True in World War One, true again in World War Two. Before and after were so different. In Alaska, that difference was a gross negative, because now finally the railroad is being a government project. It was delayed, delayed, delayed because of the war. Finally, after the war, it was slowly finished, not being finished until officially 1923. And when it was all done, Alaska was in the doldrums so bad that they could only justify one train a week from Seward to Fairbanks. And there was no traffic. So they decided they had to do something, and that something was to build up resource roads. So in the late 20s, the Alaska Road Commission and the Alaska Railroad become essentially one. And this effort is put into road development to what they consider to be resource roads. So a lot of this was going on at the time that the Horning family and Charlie Barthoff moved to the Gold Court. The road before was abysmal. It was a just a real ordeal to get anything up the road. Road Commission really put an effort into making a steady grade, something that could be used by a wheeled vehicle. Now, trucks are just coming into their own, being dramatically developed as a result of the need of World War One. So after the war, you're getting these huge developments in the utility of these large trucks, large by their standards at the time. So you really had to improve the roads for their use. This was happening. And so it became obvious that it was now possible to bring in fuel oil, for example. And you could bring in a generator or any kind of a engine that you could run a line shaft with, and your mill could be run all winter long. You weren't dependent on water power anymore. So Pearl, she wanted this to happen, and she was determined it was going to happen because she needed the cash flow for her daughter.
Okay.
So I can imagine a meeting, a family meeting, including Charlie Barthoff, and present there would be Pearl. There would be William, Alan, in his 20s. Alan isn't working at the mine. He's off on a tangent of becoming a pilot, and becomes a very good one. But Sydney is a very critical element to the mining effort. Sydney is, I use the word extraordinary, he was a very strong individual. There's many stories told about Sydney's incredible strength. Not a little bit stronger than, but take the strongest man you ever knew and double that. You know, he was phenomenal in what he could do, things he could lift, things he could move. Not a big man, but just for some reason, very strong. Let me insert right here a fast forward. It was probably 15 years ago at the mine. I just happened to look out the window of my cabin, and I could see a woman walking up the trail to my cabin very purposefully. I went out on the porch, excuse me, and greeted her, and she introduced herself as being Sydney Black's daughter.
Wow.
And that Sydney was down at the visitor center of the Independence Mine State Historic Park and wanted to come up visiting. He was 92.
Okay.
Absolutely, please. And there was quite a group of them. And they came up and they occupied my cabin. We had tea and discussion. And Sydney, even though he was 92, was very clear-minded. You'd ask him a question, and there'd be a little bit of a lag, but then a full answer. He was very cognizant of. But he was baffled by the appearance of things. Nothing looked right to him.
Right.
But I in the period of that discussion, I had asked him, Mr. Black, there's all these stories told about your strength. At your prime, how big of a man were you? And he says, you know, I was, I have no explanation for it. I never weighed more than 180, and, you know, my height is, 5'10", before I started shrinking, you know. I had nothing, no particular thing I could point to as being, but he acknowledged that, yeah, it was true, he could outdo anybody at anything. So we had a wonderful discussion with the man. I really enjoyed the conversation and so on about, and I asked him about a few issues having to do with the past. I was very careful not to ask about the critical issue having
right.
to do with Gene Horning, his sister.
Okay, I have to ask, what happened there? Where did she go?
Okay, well, here's these discussions about the mine, whether it's going to go year-round operation or not, and there's a vote taken, and the vote ends up, by gosh, let's do it. But okay. The big dissenter was William Horning. So they did this, and for the next several years, they were able to keep Gene in college. They were able to do all of these things. They had a pretty steady income coming from the mine through the year. At one point, Gene comes back from college, and Sydney talks to her in intimate detail, and he proposes marriage to her, and Jean is just, she wasn't exactly shocked, but on the other hand, she wasn't really prepared for this either, and so, you know, she didn't give him an answer, but she immediately went to talk to her mother, and all hell broke loose. Oh, my God. You know, he did what? He, you know, this was a shock to Pearl. And Pearl had all of these designs on her daughter, Jean, and by damn, she wasn't going to have her marry some kind of a common miner, no matter who he was. And, it was an ugly, ugly scene developed immediately. And Pearl... She told Sydney in no uncertain terms, Sydney, you're out of here. You know, we're going to pay you for your interest in the Goldcorp mine.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to, but we want you to leave. We want you out of here. And Sydney was just thoroughly broken. You know, he was so embarrassed by all of this. He had a cabin of his own, and he cleaned that cabin out, and he made an enormous backpack load, which included the stove, cooking stove,
okay,
from his cabin, and the oven's full, the top is full. He has to have help getting this on his back, but he didn't want to come back. It was one trip, and he's gone. Now, where he's going is over the mountain pass that we call the high-grade pass, behind the Goldcorp mine, north, which would take you down into Craggy Creek. You know, it's hard to walk that, Mike, without a pack. But there's this historic event that a lot of people talked about where he took off with this enormous load, who knows what it weighed, and he didn't look back. He went over the high-grade pass down the other side to some mining claims that he owned called the Black Claims. Today, they have been patented, and they still bear that same name, and they're in the upper Craggy Creek area. So this was in the middle 30s, and Sydney then developed the Black Claims. He had a little mill on the Craggy Creek, and there's still lots of evidence, the tram line and a few other things. But he never got over this, and he finally left Alaska in the middle 30s and went elsewhere.
Okay, but the elsewhere has to have a story because there's a daughter.
There's a daughter, yeah. He did get married. He actually married in Alaska before leaving, but they left right away after getting married. He married one of the Berry daughters. I think it was Finger Lake. They had a
I know the family.
That same family.
We are going to have to pick that up more because now you've come back into a time frame that I'm somewhat familiar with, but we have run out of time.
Oh, again, how quickly it goes.
Yeah, more story. Well, we've got to the berries. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Dan.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
We'll pick up this in the next session.